Welcome to the Casey Kowar Show, a celebration of words. I'm very pleased to have as my guest today, Tom Bailey. We're going to be discussing Mr. Bailey's novel, The Grace That Keeps This World. And it's published by Shea Earhart Books, and it came to my attention through the book's editor. And when I read the book, there were several things about the book that grabbed my attention, and Mr. Bailey and I will be discussing this during the show. So first of all, Tom, thank you for taking the time to appear on the show today.
Thank you, Casey.
Now, from what I understand, this novel began as a short story. Is that correct?
It did begin as a short story. I had the story of how the story got written was that I was had my first teaching job. I got a PhD at the State University of New York at Binghamton. And my first teaching job was at Cortland State. And I was driving up on 81, that snowy stretch of 81, in the winter to the fall. And it was the first day of buck season. And I heard a story over the radio that a father and a son had gone hunting. And the father had accidentally shot the son. And then when he saw what he'd done, he turned the gun on himself. And what I very much remember is just driving on up to Cortland and going into my office and sitting in my office, and I didn't even turn the lights on. I just sat there in the dark, and, you know, finally the telephone rang or something. But the question that haunted me was, who was that father? And it seemed to me that there were any number of ways to react to such a, you know, horrific situation. But this father had taken his own life. And when I first tried to come at it, I came at it as a short story. And what I discovered in the writing of the short story, which was a pushcart prize story, was that there were two sons, and it was sort of the second son who brought, you know, meaning to the piece. You know, brought it out of just a tragedy that you hear on the radio to something that you could feel and sort of understand. I'm not saying that makes it better, right? Just that you understand something about it. So I wrote that story. It was called Snow Dream. And when I finished the story, you know, and it was published in Double Take, and then it was, you know, as I said, a pushcart prize story, I was so pleased with myself. And then my wife read it, and she said, "And what about the mother?"
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, oh no. So I started again thinking about the mother at first, which is that prologue. But then what happened was, as I started to tell it, and I live in a very small town in central Pennsylvania these days, and what you realize about small community, of course, is the way that everyone is affected by a tragedy, not just the family. It goes much deeper than that. And what I slowly began to realize was that it wasn't just the family, but that there were all of these people involved. And I think that there were 13 first-person narrators in the book. So everybody sort of gave voice to the story that had happened. And of course, what was interesting to me about that was that as they started to speak in the first person, they're not only telling the story of the tragedy, but of course, you know, necessarily, they're telling their own story. And so each person began to speak and to talk. And when I first started to tell it, I thought of it as a kind of elegiac chorusing around a tragedy, you know. But then slowly what happened was, in the novel of it, you know, there was a plot that started to revolve, to develop. And so I just let it run. I just let everybody have their say and just rode along with those discoveries.
Tom, how long was the short story that you wrote? How many pages was that?
It must have been around 17 pages, I think.
17, okay.
Published. Yeah. 17 pages.
Okay. And, you know, when I look at a book, when I get a book, one of the things I always do is I always kind of look at the blurbs on it. And I saw that you got a blurb from Robert Coles.
Mm-hmm.
And that very much intrigued me because if there's an author that I respect in terms of having an overall knowledge of literature and writing, it's probably Robert Coles. And I'm just kind of wondering how Robert Coles discovered your novel and you know, and how he came to write the blurb for the novel.
I was in, after I got my PhD and I taught for 3 years at Cortland State, I accepted a position in the expository writing program at Harvard. And so then I went to Harvard for 5 years and taught there. And while I was there, Robert Coles was there. And I had the wonderful opportunity to meet, you know, Bob and to, you know, have breakfast with him and to talk and to, and they had accepted, they were the ones that had accepted, you know, Snowdreams. There was another guy, Jay Woodruff, who I'd gone to Iowa with, who was at that time the managing editor, who is now one of the people at Entertainment Weekly. And it was just, Bob was a huge influence in the way that I, too, had, you know, just, I'd read Flannery O'Connor's South. I had read everything that he'd written on the way that he thought about writers and writing. And I was just, you know, bowled over by the guy and just a huge fan and admired him greatly. And he was very, very kind to me and very supportive of my work, not only in Double Take, but he actually, he wrote that blurb for me for my short story collection, which was Crow-Man story. And, you know, again, you know, just championing my work and just very, very kind to me. And so we, when we went, and that was for, you know, the Snowdreams was the lead-off story in that collection. And so that when we went to the novel, he seemed like the perfect voice to speak for, you know, what this book does. I think it echoes what I tried to do in the short stories as well.
Mm-hmm. And then the other thing I must ask you about in the acknowledgments, anyone, the listeners that are familiar with the show know that Andre Debuse was a friend of mine, and I consider to be probably one of the finest writers of our generation. Andre Debuse, I love his son's work as well. But you make a special acknowledgement to the fact that his Meditations from a Movable Chair was important to you in the writing of this book. And I'm wondering if you would just tell me a little bit about how that came about.
That's a wonderful question. Andre Debuse has been my hero forever. When I was at Iowa, Anna Swamp up near Gloucester and had dinner with Andre Debuse III and his wife and kids. And I was just telling him what an influence his father had been on me. And when I was at Iowa, I had plucked down off the shelf, by the grace of God, I'd plucked down Andre's thesis, because he had also gone to Iowa. I mean, I didn't know who he was. This was back in 85, maybe.
Sure, before
and
the accident.
I read his thesis, and I just could not believe it. I thought, if I can put words to paper like this guy does, I mean, you know, this is it. This is what I want to do. What happened was that, I mean, I read everything I get my hands on by the guy. And then when I was at Harvard, I had gone to a reading with a Cambridge public library, you know, and I didn't know Andre, and he was there, and he looked great. He had this light blue flannel shirt on, his eyes were sparking, and he, of course, it was after the accident, so he was in a wheelchair.
Yeah.
And he read, and as he read, he started talking about the idea of knowing a character, and he said, during his talk, he said, you have to know what a glass of beer feels like in her hand. Not my hand, her hand.
Mm-hmm.
And that really stuck with me. There was a guy named Tony English, D. Anthony English from Oxford University Press, who came to Harvard while I was there. And one morning, Nancy Summers, who was the director of the program, said that Tony English was looking for book proposals. You know, was anybody interested? Well, you know, I put my hand on a list for 8 a.m. the next morning. I went home, cracked open a beer, and typed out 8 proposals of books that I might want to write for, you know, Oxford University Press.
Sure.
And then I met with Tony the next morning, and he looked like T.S. Eliot. He's a terrific guy, you know, and he sat there, but he was tough, and he just took each proposal that I'd written, and he said, no, 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 and he went all through it. Then I struck on one that I called On Writing Short Stories. And what I wanted to do was take several writers who I really admired or who I had studied under and have them each write an essay on some aspect of craft or something to do with writing. Well, one of the people that I had in mind, Andre Debuse, I didn't know him yet, and Mike Curtis at The Atlantic, you know, gave me his address, and I wrote him and I said, you know, I'd like to maybe do something with you on this. And he called me, and of course I'd never talked to him before. I didn't even know he's from Louisiana, and I have Southern roots too. And he said, Tom, he said, you know, he said, I just don't know if I can do this. I don't think I have anything to say. And I said, Andre, I was just there at the reading the other night, and you talked about this woman, you know, with a glass of beer in her hand, you know, and I wanted to write an essay called The Habit of Writing, which Flannery O'Connor talks about.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you could do something with this. And he said, he goes, Tom, he said, I think maybe you're right. And he had us, I know, my kids, I've got three kids, I had two at the time, little kids, and my wife, Sarah. We all went up to his place in Haverhill and had lunch. And I remember Isabel, we still tell Isabel, you know, he had this bed off to the side. He had these ramps that went up to his house, and he had this bed off to the side with these black satin sheets. And Isabel took a nap in there. She was just a baby. And that was the beginning for me, just a beautiful relationship where, you know, we would talk, and he was terrifically influential on me, not only as a writer, but as a man.
Mm-hmm.
And he would take great care with my young family, and the last time I saw him, his daughter, they were redoing his daughter's house, and he needed some help pulling out, like, junk from under the house, like old cinder block and stuff. And I signed up, you know, and I went. There was only, like, two or three of us there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the first time I met Andre Debuse III, and because he was doing the tile work. And we went down, and we did all this stuff, and I remember I was wearing my Carhartts, and we carried up these huge blocks of cinder block and stuff. And I remember we went home that day, and he was in his car, which had the thing with the wheelchair that would come out from on top of the car and come down. And we pulled up in front of his house there, and I was going to get out and get in my car and go home. And he looked at me, and he reached over across the seat, and he put his arms around me, and he just gave me this huge, hard hug. That was the last time I saw him.
Mm-hmm.
And two or three days later, it wasn't very long at all. We were going to his house for dinner, and my wife had called to ask him about what he would like to eat. And he said to her on the phone, he said, Sarah, he says, I gotta go. He says, there's something. I said, I must have eaten too many beans or something. So he gets off the phone, and she was probably the last person to talk to him.
Wow.
The guy that helped him found him in the shower, you know, face down in the shower, leaning against the wall a couple hours later. And I remember Joe Herka gave us the call the next morning, and I remember going to the gym in Cambridge, and I lift weights and stuff, and I was doing pull-ups, just weeping, just crying, you know. As I just told Andre, young Andre, I said, I miss him every day.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Let me ask you this. Father Anthony, did Andre Debuse have an impact on that character?
You're good. Yeah, he did. Of course he did. It's a father's story. I mean, it's Father Paul. I mean, you know, not really. It's a mixture of a lot of things. But I always loved the father story. The first time somebody asked me that question, I was always just enamored of, loved the relationship between the priest and a father story and the father there. And when I started writing my story, you know, that was the kind of relationship that I imagined.
Yeah.
I mean, he's a priest. He has that sort of distance. But at the same time, there's a real and genuine friendship there. And I wanted that.
And, yeah. And I think Andre would like Father Anthony a lot. And that's a compliment. So let's go to The Grace That Keeps Us World. And Tom, you tell the story, and you tell the story through many narrators. And I'm wondering, as you started out with the 17-page short story, and then you expanded into the novel, how did you decide on, because some of the characters that do some of the narration are really not that important a part of the story. And how did you decide on who was going to get to tell what part of the story and who was going to advance the plot? Because the important things that happen in the plot, we're not going to discuss what they are because we're not going to give the story away. It happens fairly late in the book. And so as you were doing this, how many new characters did you have to add to the novel?
I would have had to add 11 new characters.
11?
11. And, when I'm writing, when I'm actually composing, I guess it's the word, I try not to think too much. I try just to go with whatever the feeling of whatever's happening. Who is going to step forward and talk? Who needs to say something now? Where's the next tension that needs to be picked up? And as I was writing the book, actually, this is sort of interesting for people who are interested in craft. When I started writing the book, Anne Marie Burke, who is the waitress at the Lost Lake Diner, who seems a kind of peripheral character, was actually the second person who started to talk. Because I thought what she could do was sort of echo out some of the sadness, some of the tragedy. Not that she was directly involved, but she understood something about the boys, and certainly Gary David. And so what would happen was that I would write it, and then as it started to unfold, what is it? I can't remember who says, I try to be, I try to let just things happen, and then I try to be dumb. I always joke with my class. I try to just be dumb. And then I try to be terribly, terribly smart about what it is that I've been dumb about. And so when I would go back, I would say, all right, this is a wonderful voice, or I love the way she talks about the beach or something like that, or the gull, the carping cries the gulls or something. But then I need to move forward a narrative. And so then maybe I would go back and pull Kevin's, the younger son's narrative in a little bit closer so that we would have a kind of narrative line, which would then be, again, get that kind of elegiac coursing around the event, which I was just on a book tour down through the South, and I was in Fairhope, Alabama, at Page and Palette. And I was telling them, since I am from the South, I was saying that, it's funny to me when people say, that story doesn't really seem to be, have much to do with the plot. And I always joke, and I say, well, when Southerners start to tell a story, you ask them a question, they start to say, well, now, Bill Smythe down the road. And I said, if you don't understand that that's part of the plot, I said, you aren't listening.
Exactly. And one of the things we were talking about briefly before we started the conversation is we were talking about Shay Earhart, the imprint. And it seems to me that one of the things that I like about their books is they give their authors a lot of latitude about what they're writing about. And hunting is not a very particularly politically correct thing to write about right now. But I'll tell you what, I live in Columbus, Ohio. And on the first day of deer hunting season, they close the factories down around here because everyone goes deer hunting. And it is an amazingly popular, sport, pursuit, whatever. And I'm wondering, when you first approached them, was there any concern about, this is a literary novel and it's about, it's about hunting. Did that conversation ever come up?
My colleague here at Susquehanna University, Gary Fink, in the Rice Institute, says it's the most beautiful book about deer hunting ever written. And we laugh, but, I don't really think of it as a book about deer hunting. I think of it as a book about, a family.
Right.
But what I did notice when Shay and I were talking, when she had decided to go with this book rather than my next novel, which she had bought first, actually, called Cotton Song, was that the cover was very, very important. And I thought she did a terrific job on the cover. I mean, she does a terrific job all the way around. But in positioning it, the cover is actually the moment when Gary Hazen and his wife Susan, it's just a small, it's a line in the whole book where they're sitting on the dock in the summer you know, listening to the lap of the water against the dock. And it is so much to me a book about love.
Yes.
And I thought that, man, how did she know? How did they capture that moment in all the book's moments? You know, they don't have a deer rifle on the front or something like that.
Right.
I thought it was a terrific move, you know, just that really captured the heart of the book.
Yeah.
And I think that she's just great. Well, I think that Shay also wrote the copy on the front of the flap, and you know, she's just a genius at the way that she puts things and the way that she sees into the heart of what's most important.
And one of the things, Tom, that I particularly enjoyed about the book is, you know, I read a lot of books, and most books I read are about mothers and daughters and the relationships that they have with each other. And The Grace That Keeps This World is very much a story about a father and his relationship with his sons. And Gary is almost, I would almost consider him almost an endangered species. He's a man who lives off the land, feeds his family through kind of a form of self-reliance. And I thought it was just refreshing to read a novel about men and about the relationship that they have, because I mean, let's face it, half the population, you know, are fathers and sons, but it's not written about very often.
Well, I mean, my gosh, fathers and sons, talk about, you know, loaded territory. You know, when I wrote the book, when I wrote the short story, I wasn't a father myself.
Oh, really?
And, yeah. And now my son, my oldest son, is now 8, going on 9. And, oh my. I mean, you know, just thinking about my relationship, and I have a younger son, too. I have a daughter and who's 8, and a younger son, who's 2, going on 3. And I'm not sure how it would have changed my writing of the book, but I know... There's a kind of, I tried to explain this the other day to people. There's a toughness. My dad was through Jets and Marine Corps. My dad was not a real, my dad he's still alive, an honorable man. He's a warrior in the best sense of the word. But you know, he was tough.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He expected a job to be done in a certain way, and you know, and I think that's good training. I once said to my mother-in-law, my wife is from New York City, and I once said to her, you know, my job is not to be my son's best friend.
That's right.
Yeah, that got her attention, you know, and she said, and I didn't say that it wasn't my job to be his friend, but my first job is to be his father. And I think that you know, that's something that that seems like a, you're right, that seems endangered these days in a way, you know, where it seems like things are all supposed to be buddy buddy. And I think that a father, my dad used to always say to me, as a Marine Corps officer, he would say, you don't ask people for respect, you lead, and people learn to respect you because of the way you lead. And I think that's something that Gary Hazen understands.
Mm-hmm.
You know, certainly as a father myself, I feel that one.
Yes, and one of the books, and I mean this is very much as a compliment, that as I read it, it reminded me a bit of was The Sweet Hereafter by Russell Banks.
Mm-hmm.
And
I think The Sweet Hereafter is the most terrific book. I I'm going to say this. I knew about The Sweet Hereafter, and people had been telling me about it. I would not read it until I finished my book.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's a genius novel.
It is, and it's very much different from what you wrote. But what I like about it is that you get the individual perspectives of the different people in the story, and I think that's what's very effective. And this also captures, I think, what happens with young love when the young man falls in love for the first time, and the decisions that he has to make between the relationship between his father, his mother, and his girlfriend. And again, this is something that is approached a lot of times by in a feminine way and not in a masculine way. But men have to make these choices as well, and there are some very, very difficult decisions that are made here as a result of love. And I think you handled it very, very well.
Well, thank you. I mean, the thing that I was always afraid of in some way was a kind of corniness, you know, which is also a funny word, isn't it? That because things are sincere, truly, you know, sentiment, not sentimentality,
mm-hmm.
that they're corny. But I've said this to book groups and things before, and then they cry out, no, it's true. And so I guess what you're trying to do always is to tread that line and make it true, or as Ezra Pound said, make it new again so that people feel it and understand it, and it doesn't just become a cliche.
Yeah, and that is a tough thing to do. Now, Tom, we're not going to give away any of the plot here, because I want people to buy the book and read it. But stylistically, there's a very tragic scene in the book, and you kind of handle it almost off scene almost. And I'm wondering, as a writer, when you came to that point, how tempting was it for you to really embellish that scene, and how did you come to the decision to handle it the way you did, which I think was very effective?
Well, you know, it is funny, because when I've read some reviews of the book, there was a beautiful review in the Washington Post, I thought, and the reviewer dealt with that moment and wondered, you know, why also I had handled it that way. And I've read other reviews online, some people say, well, you should have showed that. But to me, it's the most obvious thing in the world. If I had shown that moment, which in a sense, how could you show that moment? And mm-hmm. again, right, we don't want to give anything away.
Right.
But there are some things that probably, if they happen to you, you probably may not even remember actually doing them.
Mm-hmm.
The horror of something, the full impact might be in the moment where you notice, where you see. And that's as close, probably, in a kind of first person that you can get to that moment. Technically or craft wise, that moment is a moment which, if it were given away or if I showed it, for instance, it would truncate the plot.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that although it may create a little bit of confusion for a second later on, I think for the reader comes to the realization of that moment along with the character. And I guess we should not say that it is, but you come to that moment at the same time with the same moment of going, what? And then seeing, and then feeling, and then coming to understanding. So I think that actually, if what Flannery O'Connor says is right about fiction, that what it does is it gives us it reenacts basically a felt experience. Then I think that's what fiction has to do. You have to go through that. You have to actually, you know, experience it yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that's what happened in that moment mm-hmm. of the book.
Tom, looking back on it now, you wrote the short story, which what year was that it was originally published?
What year was it? 99? 99. I may be making that up.
Yeah, no, I think it was 99.
Or 2000.
What are you happiest about with the novel, now that you wrote the short story, you took the time, you wrote the novel? What are you happiest about now that the novel has seen the light of day and you've made the changes you've made? What, as an author, what pleases you most, do you think, about the novel?
What a novel has is a kind of emotional resonance that a short story, very few short stories, can ever hope to attain. I thought that the short story was very poignant, obviously enough so that it didn't leave me alone and I had to go through and write the novel. But the novel creates a world of characters. know, I got up and I lived in Lost Lake for years writing this book.
Mm-hmm.
And even now when I go back and I look at it, Alice Walker wrote at the end of The Color Purple, she said, I'd like to thank these characters for coming.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's absolutely fabulous. And of the books that I've written, you know, The Grace That Keeps This World, the characters in The Grace That Keeps This World stay with me even now. Daily, even though I'm on my third novel after that, you know, I come back to those characters and I think about them and I think about their lives and I think that maybe they taught me something about the grace that keeps this world. They taught me about what you ought to hope for. I mean, that if like I heard that news report on the radio and the father shoots himself after finding he shot his son, and you go, my God. And then you say, what is the meaning of that? Well, there's no meaning in that.
Mm-hmm.
But the short story and then the novel amplify some sense of what it's a kind. What art can do is a kind of taming of chaos. It's a,
mm-hmm.
I mean, you could have art that would mean, could say, well, nothing means anything.
Right.
But well, I think what happens in the kind of dealing with whatever the human condition is that we try to take what we can from tragedy, from our lives, and the grace that keeps this world is more than we ought to hope for, and yet it's something.
Well, Tom, I really appreciate the time you've given us today, and what I'd like to do is, when the next novel is done and comes out, I'd like to have you on as a guest again. And I wish you and your family the best of the holiday seasons. And I highly recommend this book to people. And as I mentioned on the website, I said, give this book to people because they'll think you have good taste in literature because it's very well written.
I've been honored, Casey. Thank you so much.
Okay. You take care.
Bye.